Hear ye, hear ye, hear ye. The Honorable Supreme Court of Ohio is now in open session pursuant to adjournment.
Good morning. May be seated. First case on our calendar, 08-1133, Michael Hodesh versus Joe Corletzi. Mr. Whitman.
Thank you, Mr. Chief Justice, Associate Justices. Thank you for the opportunity. The Court of Appeals erred by first articulating a new disclosure rule for pretrial verdict contingent high-low agreements between a plaintiff and one defendant in a multiple defendant case, and then further erred by applying these new rules retroactively. The Court of Appeals also erred in its finding that this agreement was a Mary Carter agreement. The reason I say that the trial court erred in finding that this was a Mary Carter agreement is because this court has defined a Mary Carter agreement quite specifically in the past as a contract between a plaintiff and at least one defendant allying themselves against another defendant at trial. That is the definition of a Mary Carter agreement in Ohio from the two cases of Vogel versus Wells and Ziegler versus Wendell Trucking. This agreement was the antithesis of an alliance between a plaintiff and one defendant because the terms of this agreement made it mandatory that the settling parties, the plaintiff and the hospital, continued to have an adversarial relationship throughout the trial.
Counsel, was there an adversarial relationship between Jewish Hospital and the doctor?
Yes, there was.
And wasn't it the case where the hospital brought in an expert and pointed the finger at the doctor at trial as being the individual responsible for the towel count and the instruction to the hospital's employees, the nurses?
Yes, Justice O'Connor, the expert witness, Dr. Bechamp, was taken by televideo, and that deposition was actually already taken prior to the agreement being entered into.
Were there cross claims?
There were no cross claims entered.
No cross claims between the hospital or the doctor?
No.
So you'd have to infer an adversarial relationship because they hadn't pleaded causes of action against each other.
No, but the adversarial relationship was clear. The surgery was in December of 2000. The lawsuit was filed in 2002. And it was clear from the very beginning of the litigation that the parties were adversarial, the two defendants.
If the hospital chose to allay any liability that it might have on the doctor, why wouldn't a fact finder want to know what bias it had as against a co-defendant?
Well, I think.
And wouldn't they be entitled to know about bias?
If there was a bias that went beyond the ordinary adversarial relationship that already existed, in this case, the hospital had a policy, an operating room policy. That policy was that the surgeons were to use, the surgeons who had privileges to conduct surgery at the hospital, were to use the counted materials on the surgical tray. And those counted materials included the lap sponges. The surgeon chose independently, without a policy that the hospital agreed to that, to use towels, which was very problematic. So there was a natural adversarial relationship between the hospital and the doctor from the get-go, because the hospital policy, as construed by the hospital, did not allow the surgeon to use the towels in the first place. And therefore, the hospital, while there may have been bias, that bias was natural by the nature of the facts of the case.
Counsel, do you think the fact finder should be entitled to know of that bias?
The fact finder did know of that bias. There was no doubt.
The fact finder knew that the hospital had an arrangement?
No. Oh, you're talking about the bias of an arrangement with the plaintiff.
Yes.
The There was no bias created by the arrangement. There was no bias created by that agreement because, and this is the important distinction between this agreement and a Mary Carter agreement. Mr. Hodash, the plaintiff, represented to the trial court at the hearing before the trial and to Dr. Korelitz and his counsel that he intended to try the case as a joint and several liability case against the hospital as well as Dr. Korelitz. Right there, that makes it almost impossible, nothing's impossible, but it makes it almost impossible for there to have been created a bias between Mr. Hodash and Dr. Korelitz that was anything different. By the same token, it made it almost impossible for the hospital to have any additional bias created by the agreement that it didn't have in the first place, because they were still in an adversarial relationship with the plaintiff.
Did the plaintiff know about the arrangement? Did the doctor know about the arrangement before the trial?
The doctor did know about the arrangement before the trial.
How did he know?
I don't know. I don't know how the doctor.
It wasn't given to him. Was it in writing?
The agreement was in writing.
But it wasn't given to him or disclosed to him?
No, it was not.
Not part of the record?
No, it was not. It was not provided to him. It was not made part of the record. However, there was a hearing before the trial on the issue, a very substantial hearing.
Counsel, the actual agreement itself, I assume it's in the record someplace. I don't find it in the appendixes. The Court of Appeals details it. Can we look at the Court of Appeals opinion? Is that accurate? And it lists like 10 provisions.
Of course, I would prefer the court look at the actual agreement.
And that's in the record someplace.
Yes.
Under seal. It was filed under seal, which we have.
Yes. Right. It should be as of record.
All right. Ms. Keyes-Walker argues that whatever you call it, and the term Mary Carter gets thrown around and means different things in different states and different things to different people. The Court of Appeals, as I read their opinion, just says this is a Mary Carter, period. And then they also do another thing. They say, We're entitled to a de novo review here instead of abuse of discretion. You haven't mentioned that, and in reading it, I'm not sure how they conclude they're entitled to do that.
Well, the Court of Appeals was of the opinion that because the trial court did not actually read the agreement and accepted it in chambers, in camera, that he was not entitled to deference. I would say that in answer to your question about the standard of review, that because the contingency agreement is in the nature of a contract, the construction of that contract would be a de novo review. However, where the Court of Appeals erred was in reviewing then the other parts that have to be reviewed by the trial court, which is whether there was any collusion, whether the agreement realigned the parties to the detriment or to the prejudice of Dr. Korelitz. Those matters, that the Court of Appeals erred because those matters should be reviewed on the abuse of a discretion standard.
Well, and the Court of Appeals also, and Ms. Keyes-Walker doesn't even recommend that, essentially seems to say that all of anything that is in the nature of a pretrial settlement that has a defendant, even a straight high-low, without all the permeations that yours has to be disclosed in detail and disclosed to the jury. So they went, and even Ms. Keyes-Walker doesn't suggest that that needs to be done, but that's
no,
the way I read their opinion.
It's actually interesting that our two propositions of law are pretty similar. I think the only distinction is that we urge the court to follow the lead of the most recent case on this issue in Connecticut, the Monty case, where the trial court urges that the trial court or the court there urges that the trial court should have discretion
and
if there's collusion.
Then let me take you to the agreement. I didn't look at the sealed one. I looked at what the Court of Appeals detailed it. I have trouble understanding the built-in collusion or the built-in incentive for the hospital to drive the verdict higher against the doctor. I can't figure out how the Court of Appeals concluded that. What provision? Is it the provision that says if it's more than $250,000, the hospital doesn't pay anything?
Justice Pfeiffer, one of the things that I hope everybody understands is the care that this provision and this agreement was negotiated. The contingencies in the agreement make it to the hospitals, it makes it really very improbable that the hospital would have any incentive to increase damages under any contingency. And there were multiple contingencies because it was a complex situation with multiple parties. And all of these contingencies, for the reason that it would be clear to the settling parties, were meticulously mapped out.
Well, there's a contingency even for contribution if you can get the doctor to settle as
that
well.
That was a very important provision, and I want to clarify that, because the Court of Appeals did latch on to this one small provision in the agreement as being the most important provision in the agreement, that being that if the verdict was against Dr. Korolits only, that and it was in an amount over $250,000, the hospital would pay nothing. However, that agreement was modified so that it would not be collusive in nature. It would not give the hospital incentive to drive up the damages by two other provisions, one of which was the settlement provision. And
the other one was that if the doctor or his insurance company didn't pay up in 30 days, the hospital had to pay.
And that's exactly what happened. So what the purpose of those provisions were, manifestly on the face of the agreement, I think the most reasonable construction is that it was intended, if that eventuality occurred, to put $250,000 on the table for the doctor as free money to pick up and to use to settle the case. The provision was actually intended, if that contingency occurred, to give the doctor incentive to come to the table and negotiate settlement after trial, because there had been so much trouble negotiating a settlement before trial.
And as this went to the jury had, let me walk you through the choices. They could find 100, this was not a case in which the plaintiff was going to have any contributory negligence or assumption of the risk or anything like that. So it was going to be a plaintiff's verdict. Period.
I believe that would be, I don't think there would be any other possible conclusion on that.
So the jury could award 100% against the hospital, 100% against the doctor. Could it find joint and several, so it just made one award and did not apportion it, or did the jury have to apportion?
No, there was certainly opportunity for a joint and several verdict, and plaintiff vigorously pursued that verdict.
So they could do 100% hospital, 100% doctor, or joint and several, or apportion.
But nobody asked for an apportion. Nobody requested any apportionment, and at that time it was not an appropriate jury instruction or verdict form. May I reserve the final minute?
Yes, except I have a question on the proposition of law. It seems to me we need to clarify the duty of the trial judge in a situation such as this to either do as a trial judge here, that we sanction what the trial judge here was to take the agreement and not read it. Looked like gave the impression they just didn't want to take the time to read the agreement, which the law in other states seems to be generally that the trial judge doesn't just take the word of the attorneys who formed the agreement, but the trial judge actually reads it to determine whether the jury needs to have access to it or whether there it's a Mary Carter agreement, whether somebody's prejudiced by it. What should we say about the trial court's conduct in this case in setting a rule of law?
Well, I understand the problem that the Court of Appeals had and that the justices here may have with the trial court not reading the agreement. Of course, I think you have to look at it in context, that once the trial court had the hearing and determined that the parties had indicated to him that the agreement was confidential, and that the plaintiff intended to vigorously pursue joint and several liability, at that point, based upon Ziegler and Vogel, the trial court knew it wasn't a Mary Carter agreement and accepted the agreement in camera.
Well, he knew based upon the representation of the lawyers representing the two parties who formed the agreement.
Well,
it's in their interest, obviously, certainly, to convince him that this is not a Mary Carter agreement, wasn't it?
Sure, but I mean, if the trial had gone forward and plaintiff had not presented a nurse expert against the hospital or a
trial judge, you think could have at some point during the trial could have done something?
Absolutely. I mean, they could have opened the agreement, could have ordered it disclosed. Dr. Korlitz never asked, never felt the need to ask for any disclosure after the day before trial.
Wouldn't a better rule of law for us to announce be that under these circumstances, a trial judge should always read the agreement? I mean, that seems to me that can avoid, now he read it afterwards, after the trial, and there may not be any prejudice. We'll decide to see, but it seems to me a better rule of law for us to announce would require the trial judge to read the agreement, wouldn't it?
I understand that this court may feel it necessary to make some more bright line rules about what to do with these agreements. I certainly understand that. And I would hope that they would be applied prospectively.
Yes. Thank you, Mr. Whitman.
Thank you.
Ms. Keith Walker.
Your Honors, may it please the Court, my name is Irene Keyes Walker, and I represent Dr. Korlitz in this case. A few factual clarifications. One, I want to make sure it's clear that Dr. Korlitz not only did not know the terms of this agreement at any time prior to judgment being entered on the jury verdict, but wasn't even sure there was an agreement until the last day of trial. Counsel refused to state on the record whether they had entered into any agreement, much less what kind it was, and stated that, and the trial judge simply said, well, if you have a high-low, you must submit it to me under seal before the trial is done. If you have a Mary Carter, you must disclose it now.
The counsel in their briefs say that there was an extensive hearing, even though the judge didn't read the agreement. Was your counsel and your client's counsel part of that hearing?
In the hearing, Your Honor, consisted entirely of our counsel's insistence that there be a statement on the record as to whether an agreement had been entered into, and then to know what the terms of that agreement was so he could know if it were a Mary Carter agreement, whether or not he could get additional peremptories, he could cross-examine witnesses, all the prophylactic protections that are required for that kind of agreement depending on its terms. But counsel never went so far as to say anything other than, I've had separate negotiations with both parties. If the hospital thinks anything more needs to be said, dot, dot, dot. I mean, that was the end of it. And then the court on the last day of trial said, well, I've received under seal an agreement that counsel tells me is a high-low. Before that time and that beginning of the trial, the only thing that happened in the hearing was the judge said, if you have a Mary Carter, you must disclose it now. And counsel said, to my knowledge, I don't have a Mary Carter.
Do you think a high-low must be disclosed? Does a high-low agreement need to be disclosed,
you know,
as a Mary Carter?
That, Your Honor, is really the crux of the rule that this court has to define. And I've talked to a lot of lawyers on both sides, trial lawyers, and they really don't want me to screw this one up.
What? Is that a legal phrase?
It's a legal phrase. Here's my understanding of it. Number one, trial lawyers on both sides of the aisle use high-lows a lot.
Yes.
They find them very useful.
Right.
9 times out of 10, maybe even 99 out of 100, they're not entered into until trial has started. Often not until the plaintiff is rested, many times not until the jury's deliberated. And they also have a very bright line rule for defining high-lows, which is in this court's opinion in Ziegler versus Wendell. And it says The damages assessed against the non-agreeing defendant do not impact the high-low, the damages that are paid by the agreeing defendant. That's the bright line rule. You don't even have the non-agreeing defendant in your agreement. This is just a two-party agreement with no impact at all based on what this person may have as a verdict. And that bright line, they also want to keep confidential. I am assuming here, I believe they probably want to keep it confidential because plaintiff really doesn't want the other defendant to know how low they're willing to go for, and defendant doesn't want to know the other defendant to know how much they're willing to pay. But
well, the plaintiff's bar brief, whatever the what they call themselves now, the Association of Justice brief, makes the point that there are four different scenarios, as you know, and three of them provided for reduction in the hospital's exposure in direct proportion to a lower award against defendant appellee. Now, that obviously argues in favor of this being an acceptable agreement. What's your response to that statement?
Well, and I would start out by saying I think the agreement's acceptable. I think it's enforceable. I just think it needed to be disclosed to the jury, like the Court of Appeals said, with these particular provisions. To the jury. This particular one, yes, Your Honor, because
really?
Of the conditions, because of the fact that if an award of $250,000 against Dr. Korlitz alone was entered, the damages owed by the hospital was zero, because probably also importantly the fact that we had an agreement that the hospital, that the plaintiff would not assert a punitive damage cause of action or collect any punitive damages that might have been awarded by the hospital.
Why not just tell the jury about insurance then, too? If you're going to tell them about these high-lows, you might as well tell them who's got insurance and who doesn't.
If it were a high-low, Your Honor, I do not think that it should have been disclosed to the jury. It's because it was clearly not a high-low. And this goes back to your question, Justice Moyer, about, well, weren't three of the four scenarios. Not the way I look at it. Many of the scenarios held that the amount the hospital had to pay decreased as the amount that the Dr. Korlitz had to pay increased. For example, the hospital guaranteed $175,000 at least. So if the judgment against Dr. Korlitz was less than $170,000, then the hospital would make up the difference. But that meant every increment that it got higher towards $175,000 was a lower payment by the hospital. The next benchmark was $250,000. If the award,
I fail to understand how it's problematic if the verdict is totally against Dr. Korlitz, the hospital pays nothing. That's the end result of the jury verdict. If the hospital is found not liable, the hospital pays nothing anyway. I don't see how that creates any prejudice. I fail to understand. I don't get the connect there.
Because under the agreement, the hospital has agreed to pay $175,000 as an absolute minimum. So we're no longer in a situation where the hospital is going to pay according to what the jury verdict says of zero. The only time the hospital can pay zero is if the jury finds against Dr. Korlitz only.
But they still have the caveat that if the Dr. Korlitz doesn't pay in 30 days, they'll still up the 175, which is exactly what happened.
And I have two things to say about that, Your Honor. The first is that caveat is, of course, an entirely separate sentence. And what that is the additional benefit to the hospital of basically buying no appeal. They're willing to pay $175,000 if Hodesh takes no appeal against them and dismisses them with prejudice. To my mind, that is a wholly separate ability to an agreement by them. And I know counsel brings up this settlement provision and saying, well, also if we settled with Dr. Korlitz post-verdict, then the hospital would have to pay another $75,000. I don't interpret the language that way. The hospital doesn't interpret the language that way or say anything about it in their brief. And my guess is if that scenario had occurred, the hospital would have distinctly disagreed with the fact that after having said that they would pay $175,000 for a release with prejudice, that they somehow had to come up with an extra $75,000 because Hodesh decided to settle post-trial, post-verdict.
Counsel, I'm having a hard time on understanding where we're going to, in this fact scenario, if we go through the whole record, how we ever find that the hospital and the doctor weren't completely adversarial from start to finish.
I'll give you one example.
There's a towel in the patient, and the hospital says, you don't put towels in patients. It's not standard practice of medicine, and so our nurses don't count. They count sponges, they count everything else that goes in, but they're not responsible for counting towels. The doctor did it, and it's his responsibility. And he says, the nurses are there to keep track of those things. I've got to focus on the surgery, and the nurses are supposed to count everything that goes in and goes out. So they're button heads from start to finish. Agreement or no agreement, they're still totally adversarial in this. They're never going to be aligned with each other.
Well, and I agree. Foreign body case, redundant procedures they should have. You know, both people need to make sure everything's counted. Neither one did in this case. So that's your situation. But let me give you one clear example. Remember, this is a case that also had fraud, spoliation, punitive damage claims.
Right.
Remember that the contingency agreement had as one of its provisions that Hodesh would not assert a cause of action for punitive damages against the hospital and would not collect any punitive damages awarded against the hospital. Look at page 22 of the hospital's own amicus brief. There they say, because we had settled the punitive damage claim that plaintiff asserted against us, we didn't oppose the bifurcation motion by Dr. Korlitz, because it was no longer in our interest to do so. Translate, because our interests were then aligned with the plaintiff.
They're not obligated to help him at all, are they? I mean, they have no legal duty to help the doctor get out of this pickle.
No.
With or without the agreement.
But if they had not settled the punitive damage claim against
them, doesn't that get mooted by the fact that the judge directed out the punitive damage? It doesn't even go to the jury. So it doesn't matter in this case.
One of the errors asserted on the appeal of this case was that because all of that evidence came in, and because all of that evidence was focused on Dr. Korlitz and Dr. Korlitz only, that was an error, that it hadn't been taken out at the summary judgment stage, it hadn't been taken out before all of these allegations. And then you have, you know, the hospital getting up in closing argument.
Wasn't the punitive focused on the fact that when the doctor found the towel, first when he looked at the x-rays, he's going, that's fecal material and not a towel. And then when he goes in and finds the towel, he tells the nurse, throw it away. That was the case for punitives.
That was the case at trial, Your Honor, after this agreement had been entered into, but the punitive damage claim had been asserted against the hospital before then. Now, how the evidence would have been different, who would have done what differently, these are all questions we never know. We do know that the hospital put on witnesses, or the plaintiff put on hospital witnesses talking about, well, the doctor did this and the doctor did that, having to do with those issues that you talk about, but what other issues of spoliation, of whether the nurses should have retained the towel, who did what? It could have been anything, and that's the problem with the court and the trial judge taking counsel's word on the last day of trial, when it's too late anyway, instead of looking at it beforehand. And if you want a bright line rule that the courts and counsel can all apply, it's very easy. You have a high-low agreement is one that is not impacted by damages asserted against the non-agreeing defendant, and don't have these additional conditions as to how much and what damages will be contested, as to whether punitive damages will be asserted, as to whether plaintiff or to whether the hospital must bring its expert to Cincinnati to sit in a hotel room ready to testify live, and plaintiff can use them if plaintiff sees fit to do so. In this case, he decided to use a video instead. But that agreement required the hospital to bring the expert there alive.
So, Ms. Keyes-Walker, what would you have the trial judge do when faced with this type of agreement?
This type of agreement, Your Honor, I think the trial court is going to have to look at it and decide which are the provisions that have some potential to skew.
And this should be done before the jury?
Before the jury is even seated, because allowing additional peremptories to the non-agreeing defendant is one of the provisions that could happen. And in this case, perhaps what the Court of Appeals found, a very defense-oriented juror being excused by the hospital using a peremptory, might not have happened had the peremptories been realized.
Counsel, is it, you started out by saying that many of these agreements are entered into at trial as opposed to pretrial. So how does that work in your scenario of disclosing this, having it all out there before the jury's seated?
That most high-low agreements are entered into, these very simple agreements that's not impacted by damages of co-defendant, that don't have conditions, that don't have 16 paragraphs. Those kinds of agreements, I don't think, do need to be disclosed because they don't impact anybody except the two parties making the agreement of a high-low.
But you're not advocating for the high-lows. You're advocating when these agreements, these sophisticated, you know, multifaceted agreements are in existence, it's done on the eve of trial. That needs to be put out there on the record.
Exactly, Your Honor. I'm saying
then it's up to the judge to determine what components of that agreement can be shared, can be examined through the witnesses.
Your Honor. And it's going to be easier because the parties will have a bright line rule. Rather than trying to define Mary Carter agreements, contingent verdict agreements, which can
it doesn't matter. Under your scenario, it doesn't matter what you label them. If it has the appearance, such as this agreement, those provisions that impact the impartiality or
have the potential to.
Right. Okay.
Have the incentive to.
Let me ask you another question then. The appellant started to say in response to a question of mine that the expert witness for the hospital recorded his testimony prior to this agreement, and they used that testimony, and it was not changed as a result. How does that impact here?
There was an agreement to bring that expert to Cincinnati. That's part of the contingency agreement, to be available to testify live. Now, for whatever strategic reasons, Hodesh decided to go ahead and use a videotape instead of bringing him on live. We don't know all of those strategies, which is exactly why we argue that courts can't go back and analyze in hindsight strategy to say, well, this agreement didn't affect that strategy, or, you know, really the hospital didn't want that defense-oriented juror for their own reasons. That is not a workable rule. What is workable, the one bright line rule you can define, is a simple high-low. And every trial attorney I've talked to understands that if I make an agreement at any time with the other side that isn't impacted by damages awarded against a non-agreeing defendant, doesn't have any other conditions, doesn't have any other contingencies, that is a simple high-low, and I'm safe. And the court knows that I'm safe. If it's just a cap and a ceiling on my verdict and your verdict between the two of us. So my suggestion is everything but that be something that must be disclosed to the court and the other side so that the other side can argue which prophylactic.
And then should there be a special rule for a Mary Carter agreement?
I'm sorry.
Should there then be a special rule for what is defined by our court as a Mary Carter?
I think that that Mary Carters are a spectrum that all fall outside of high-lows. That's how I read Ziegler, to say high-lows, okay. Everything else has some aspects of a Mary Carter agreement, because a Mary Carter agreement isn't a contract to lie, size, or change alliances, or collude. That's what a law note calls.
And all you're advocating for all of those others that fall outside of a pure high-low is disclosure to the trial court and exercise of its discretion?
Disclosure to the trial court and non-agreeing defendant, because that will aid the court in exercising its discretion if someone can point out to the court, this unusual provision has this impact on me.
I thought you argued earlier you wanted it disclosed to the fact finder, the jury.
This particular agreement, I believe, went so far that it had to be, I think the appellate court was right in that it has to be disclosed to the jury.
So that's a third step then.
Right.
And how do we define which ones get disclosed to the fact finder?
That you have an abuse of discretion standard. So you're going to accord wide deference to the court. You're going to have opposing counsel arguing why it makes sense that this prophylactic measure be taken over that prophylactic measure. And you have what you have in all situations, both sides informed, able to argue, and the court balancing them and exercising his discretion.
Thank you. So, Ms. Keyes-Walker, if I can clarify, high-low, no disclosure is necessary. If it's agreement that has extra conditions and has been negotiated in the way this one has, disclosure to the court before trial and also disclosure to the non-agreeing party. And then it's up to the trial court to exercise its discretion as to whether to share any portion of it with a jury.
Exactly.
Okay.
I'm going to take you back to the issue that I think we have to write about, and that is the duty of the responsibility of the trial judge to do what you say he should have done here. Assuming that we agree with you and we say here the trial court erred by not reading the agreement and deciding whether the jury should have reviewed at least parts of it to determine whether there's a conflict. The trial judge did that after the trial, and you just indicated that the court appeals test would be abuse of discretion. Can we determine from this record whether your client was prejudiced?
Yes, Your Honor. And I think that it has to be because exactly what you said, the error occurred when the trial judge refused to look at or order the disclosure of this agreement. And if he had looked at it, it would clearly have not been the simple high-low talked about in Ziegler at a minimum should be disclosed.
But let's get away from the high. I agree with you. I think we've got these terms that really aren't helping us. We need to get to what's the issue, and that is whether one party is prejudiced by this agreement that other parties have entered into, whatever we call them. There's a lot of evidence, it seems to me, that indicates that the hospital here put on a vigorous defense. I mean, as you know, that's one of the appellant's arguments, is that they acted as if they were going to be liable, and it was in their interest to reduce the liability. Can we determine from the record whether your client, whether the doctor was prejudiced? Is that possible for us to do?
I believe so, Your Honor, because all of these agreements, when the non-agreeing party's damages impact the damages paid or the amount paid, when you have conditions and additional promises, they have a skewing potential and they have an incentive to increase the damages, in this case, against the doctor. And it is that incentive and that potential that causes a prejudice. It's not just what Dr. Corlitz would have done differently had he known the terms. It's what would plaintiff have done differently? What would the hospital have done differently? In this situation, the hospital in closing argument gets up and says, you know, this is really hard for me, especially since for some reason, Dr. Corlitz seems to think that there's an alliance or in cahoots. That kind of thing prejudices the jury against the doctor. Now, whether I don't think the parties in this case intended to collude. I think they pushed the envelope too far. They were very creative and they were very intense. But whether the hospital would have opposed bifurcation, whether the plaintiff would have said, well, never mind about bringing Dr. Beecham's down here live, I'll get rid of that provision. All of those things would have changed the facet of the trial.
Well, counsel, what I don't understand is where in the law does a defendant have a right to the assistance of another defendant in a case?
He doesn't, Your Honor, but he also has the right to be informed of provisions of agreements that impact the incentive of that defendant. Sure, the defendant may not want to help Dr. Corlitz, but he's not going to try to drive up the damages because he gets a zero if they go over $250,000.
Yeah, but
where is the prejudice in this record?
I'm sorry?
Where is the prejudice in this record?
I think the prejudice was in through And again, the prejudice has to do with everything that might have gone differently, which is why this court remands in statu quo ante, because we don't know how this case would have unfolded had the judge done what he was supposed to do pretrial. The prejudice is to the system, in that this agreement was kept secret from the jury and they were not informed when they were hearing, well, I don't know what Dr. Horlitz is talking about, thinking that we have some kind of alliance here. They didn't know. They made an uninformed verdict when they heard all of the evidence on punitive damages and spoliation against Dr. Horlitz only. And Dr. Horlitz didn't know to be able to stand up and say, yeah, well, they entered a secret agreement to drop the punitive damage claim against the hospital. Those elements of what would have happened, might have happened, could have happened by three different entities in this case are the prejudice in this case, and it's a prejudice to the system of having secret agreements that impact the way the evidence comes in.
I think we understand your position, Ms. Keith Walker.
Maybe this will be a brief question here at the end of the line. What is the practical effect of what you're urging this court to do, in a sense, disclose any agreement that's other than pure high-low between the agreeing parties that has no effect upon the non-agreeing party? Is it essentially these are going to go away because the parties won't enter them if the terms are going to be disclosed?
No, it actually seeks to preserve the high-low agreement.
No, I don't mean the high-low agreement. Okay. The other.
Well, yes, Your Honor, except for those that are such, if the conditions are such that they don't need to be kept secret, then they probably are not going to skew the proceedings. People don't need to keep them secret unless they're going to have some impact that would otherwise not be clear.
Well, wouldn't a provision, I mean, it sounded like here they, another motive was to try and get the doc or his insurance company to join in a settlement. So in addition to high-low, wouldn't the most normal additional provision be, here's what we're willing to do to settle the case. This is what we'll do to settle the case. Now, that's not the high-low, and you wouldn't want to disclose that necessarily to the other defendant, would you?
That, to me, disclosed to the other side would definitely encourage settlement, because then you're two-thirds of the way there.
Yeah, that would encourage settlement, you
yes.
think?
Counsel, if getting back to the question about the trial judge's performance here and not reading the agreement, taking the word of the, and you said under your scenario, it would be a review for abuse of discretion as to what the trial judge allowed to be introduced into evidence as a result of the components of that agreement. It's not an abuse of discretion, though. You're not advocating the application of an abuse of discretion on whether or not to read the for the judge to read it, where the judge says, you know, I don't, under my, it's my discretion and I'm not going to read it until the end or whatever. That's not abuse of discretion. That's mandatory under the scenario.
That is a rule of law. That's okay. De novo. Yes, Your Honor.
Okay.
Thank you, Ms. Keith Walker.
Thank you.
Mr. Whitman, you've used your time, but we've taken Ms. Keith Walker well beyond her 15 minutes, so begin with a minute.
Thank you, Mr. Chief.
Counsel,
so
that, I can get my question in, counsel.
Yes.
I'd like to ask the same question. If we were to accept the appellee's suggestion that anything other than what has been referred to as a pure high-low be disclosed, is that, in essence, do away with these contingent agreements that to which a non-party is or a non-agreeing party is involved?
I don't know, Justice Culp. I really don't know what would happen there. I've obviously spent a lot of time thinking about this matter and the effect that disclosure of an agreement like this would have on a jury, and a lot of things are disclosed to jury that we lawyers think are going to be terrible and they turn out to be great. I mean, it doesn't really I really don't know whether lawyers are ever going to be deterred from creatively settling cases, if that's what the question is. I don't know that a case like this with two defendants that are adversarial can have a what you call a pure high-low without considering the other issues that may follow in a verdict, because it doesn't, it's not a rational way to actually settle with a pretrial verdict contingent agreement, to just have a straight high-low with one party and not another party involved at all. So if the question is can the court cure parties settling by making a bright line rule like this? I just don't know the answer to that. And I wish I could. But if I could just address the real issue, it seems to me, isn't it collusion and prejudice to Dr. Korolits? It seems to me that that's really the central issue. And Dr. Korolits knew that there was an agreement. In fact, if I want to correct also one of the statements of fact, which is at the pretrial, at the prejudgment interest hearing, the question was raised when the agreement was given to the judge, and Mr. Calderhead, Dr. Korolits's lawyer, said a sealed envelope was produced on the second or third day of trial, and that corrected what the trial court had said before, that he thought it was at the end of the trial. And I could direct your attention to a page, which would be page 85 and 86 of the prejudgment interest transcript. So the point is that Dr. Korolits never, during an eight-day trial, raised the issue. He never attempted to cross-examine a witness. He never asked the trial court to disclose the agreement to him because he saw collusion or prejudice to himself. He never asked to voir dire any of the witnesses to see if they were biased by the agreement. He had a hospital representative sitting right next to him at the table. He never asked to call her as a witness and to see if there was any bias. That's waiver. He's obviously, Dr. Korolits saw no prejudice.
Mr. Whitman, would you agree that if we were to agree with Ms. Keyes-Walker about the rule that a judge, first of all, should read the agreement, secondly, that the judge should disclose it to the other side, and then thirdly, the judge should have discretion as to whether to impart it to the jury. Do you find that to be troublesome?
Not
from
really.
Your perspective?
Not really. I find it to be a reasonable rule. However, that was not the rule at the time that we created the agreement, and the trial judge was following the law as he understood it, and I think is a reasonable reading of Ziegler and Vogel.
You just want it to be prospective, is that it?
I would urge, if the court feels that a bright line rule is appropriate, and I understand based on the national survey and so on, I can understand that position.
Or an alternative would be we could find that it applies to this case, but that there was no prejudice to the defendant in this matter, or to the Korolits.
That would also be true, I think. That would be a correct finding. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Whitman. The case is submitted. You'll be advised of our opinion.